Your country is now almost 25 years independent. Would you do me the favor and look back for me? What went good? What went wrong within these last 25 years?
Well, I think the past 25 years were very different from what we expected when we became independent in 1991. In the first place, we felt in 1991 that war was behind us, that we would not have to go to war again, that this would be peace, and that our efforts would be focused on building a nation at peace. That was not the case. We had problems from Sudan, problems from Yemen initially, and then we had to fight a two-year, very destructive war with Ethiopia. So that was something that was unexpected in terms of what we envisaged in 1991. And then we faced externally a very hostile environment. If you look at these 25 years, the first 7 years were years of relative peace, of stability, of a conducive regional international environment. But the past 18 years have been years of war, of the aftermath of war, of hostility from the United States, misunderstanding of what Eritrea is about by much of the European countries. So we found a very difficult situation. I think, given that reality, we feel we have made some remarkable achievements. The most important one for me is that we have peace, internal peace, we have stability, we have a very safe country, we have a fair, not fair, a remarkable degree of tolerance and harmony in our society. This is a small country, but a diverse one, and we live in a region of fragmentation, of conflict, of violence, of extremism, of terrorism. We've been able to avoid that and maintain a very harmonious relationship in a very diverse society. So I believe that is very important. Another achievement for Eritrea, I believe, is that we've been able to maintain a government that is true to its vision, true to its commitment. This is not a government that has enriched itself at the expense of the citizens of this country. This is a government that lives very honest lives, very normal lives. It has not looted the resources of the country, but has essentially sacrificed everything to build this country. Doesn't mean it has not made mistakes, but it means that the vision and the commitment has remained true. If you look at the experience of countries that achieved independence after a liberation war, and there are many examples of that, you find the people that fought for freedom and liberation within very few years after taking power are the richest people in those countries. And they got those riches not because they worked for them, but because they used their place in power, their position in power, to enrich themselves. This is a very different example. I believe that's also very important in our case because we have this committed a clean government that has remained true to its vision. Economically, we don't believe we have achieved what we thought we would have achieved in the past 25 years. The situation has been very difficult for us. First 7 years were years of continuous growth, a lot of building of the economy, but war is a very destructive thing. So the war, the aftermath of the war, the fact that we cannot make use of some of our very important assets like our ports has created a difficult situation for us. So that is one of the areas where we feel our achievements have been very limited. Despite that, we feel we have made a lot of progress in the human resources development, in education, in health, in building of the infrastructure, in maintaining a standard of economy and living, which has meant that we have not had to depend on food aid, for instance. You know, we talk about an economically difficult situation, but given our very difficult situation of war and other difficulties, we feel even the economy, although it has not grown to the extent that we wanted, it has also avoided a very disastrous situation. We have had inflation of 8%, sometimes 10%, sometimes 12% a year. But compared to other countries which experience economic difficulties and have inflation rates of 50%, 100% more, we feel it is something that we've been able to manage in that sense. We have had migration, especially the past 5-6 years. Again, there are many factors to that. Migration today is a worldwide phenomenon. For a small country, it really pains us to see many of our young people leave the country to seek a better opportunity, especially in Europe. But then again, they remain an asset for Eritrea. They maintain their links with the country. They come to visit the country regularly. They support their families. Some of them are getting an education and gaining skills. Some are working and making some money. So we expect eventually this will also be a positive asset for the country. The Eritrean diaspora has always been strong for Eritrea, and it continues to be strong. But despite that, the migration is a very painful one. Our young people have been victims of human trafficking. They have suffered in the hands of human traffickers. Some of them have died crossing the Mediterranean to get to Europe. That's a very painful thing for us. But as I said, within a time where migration is on the rise globally, and given what we believe are the wrong policies of the European countries, which give blanket political asylum to Eritreans because they misunderstand the situation in the country. Given those factors, we feel we have managed that as well. And those numbers are beginning to come down now. And we have a program to provide adequate opportunities for our young people in the next 3 to 4 years. So on balance, I think we could say, personally, I can say that this has been a very painful, a very difficult but years, but also years where we maintained the dream of building a just, a prosperous and independent nation for which Eritreans fought for 50 years.
You tackled all the points I wanted to discuss with you a little bit more deeper. Ethiopia, starting with Ethiopia. What is the real situation between these two countries right now, especially on the border? What is going on there?
There's nothing going on in the border. There are troops on both sides of the border. There are small incidents that take place, once in a while, but fairly normal situation on the border. The problem between our two countries is not a border problem anymore. We went to war, we went to arbitration. That border has been decided on. It has been demarcated, so we don't believe that's an issue. We really don't see that there are or should be problems between Eritrea and Ethiopia. These are countries that are neighbors, that are very close to each other historically, politically, culturally, in many, many ways. Our economies are complementary. We stand to gain if we cooperate. So we really don't see that there are...
But there is no contact. There's nothing. The border's closed, and there's even no telephone line, I think, going crossing the border.
That is true. I believe, and Eritrea believes, that the problem for Eritrea, at least, is not Ethiopia. It has always been the United States. If you look at the war that we fought in 1998-2000, the peace agreement that was signed in 2000, and what has happened since, you can see the big and negative role that the United States played in this. The United States, when the war started, took Ethiopia's side. And then it was the arbitrator, it was the negotiator, it was the mediator. It wrote the peace agreement. It gave us a guarantee that if it's violated, it would take action unilaterally, as well as through the United Nations under Chapter 7. The decision was made in 2002. Instead of supporting that decision and asking Ethiopia, which refused to accept it, to honor its commitments, accept the demarcation of the border, normalize its relations with Eritrea, it felt that because of its perceived analysis of the situation in Ethiopia, where it felt that the Ethiopian government was weak, and that if it accepted the boundary resolution, then it could fall. It provided cover for Ethiopia not to accept the boundary the boundary decision, and it has continued to support Ethiopia, including by turning a blind eye to its violation of international law, its repression inside the country, and many other things, and it's continued to be hostile towards Eritrea. This is the real problem. If the U.S. in 2002 had insisted on the implementation of the boundary agreement, and if Ethiopia had accepted it, and if relations between Ethiopia and Eritrea were normalized at that time, today Eritrea would be in a completely different situation.
So you live, but to summarize, you live in a kind of frozen conflict. And is this the right word? Or
No, not for us, you know. Mm.
You are in peace, or what is now the situation between the two countries?
There are no relations between Eritrea and Ethiopia now. Mm. But
there's even no war situation, definitely.
There is no hot war between the two countries. Ethiopia is occupying Eritrean territory today. But for Eritrea... like I said, if the United States would take a position of supporting international law and an internationally a binding international agreement and stop its very negative role in this region, this problem would have been solved a long time ago. But the Eritrean approach is to say, okay, the United States has not done that. Ethiopia does not want to... pull out from the areas in Eritrea that it has occupied. It does not want to resolve its problems with Eritrea. So for us, our approach is to say, we'll focus on development, we'll focus on domestic issues, with the confidence that eventually Ethiopia has no other option but to pull out and normalize its relations with Eritrea.
But still, this conflict, however you call it, is a reason for you to have an army going on in a kind of alert situation, and you have the national service that is also like linked to the situation you have on the border. So I do not get it together. So why do you have on one side, are you in a kind of alarm situation, but on the other side it's rather calm on the border, the conflict?
Well, there are two things. Eritrea and Ethiopia went to war in 1998 when they were the best of friends. If you had asked me in 1998 whether war was possible, I would have said no. Even a week, 2 weeks before the war actually took place. If you ask me today whether another war is possible between Eritrea and Ethiopia, I'll say it's very highly unlikely. But given the experience of 1998, I cannot say never, it's not going to happen. If two countries go to war when they're the best of friends, you cannot absolutely rule out that they could go to war again. So we have to maintain a certain vigilance, if you will. But we don't let that hold us hostage. You know, we focus, as I said, on development, on developing our country. This is our approach.
But what does this national service mean then? What is it? Is it
National service started in 1994. This is before the war. And the reason for it was something very simple. If you look back at our experience as a liberation movement, we fought a 30-year war, but we fought it as volunteers. We were not soldiers. We were not paid. Everyone left his house, a farmer, a worker, a doctor, an engineer, an artist, a musician, everyone. They left their homes to fight for the independence of the country. And they were trained as soldiers. Some of them actually fought in the armed units. Others worked in what we used to call the base area, providing support. But everyone was a soldier. But everyone also was a mechanic, a civilian, right? Mm. So when we became independent in 1991, and given our analysis that we would not have to fight another war again, when we came to Asmara in 1991, when we liberated the country, we had about 100,000 people in our army at that time. And we demobilized 90,000 of them. We just kept a very small army. And our thinking, again, was very simple. We said, as an independent country, we don't need a big standing army. We cannot afford a big standing army. And we don't want to encourage a militarist culture of a professional soldier. So we said we'll have a very small standing army, mainly Air Force, Navy, units that require equipment, that require longer training, and we demobilize everyone. And we would have, again, continue our experience as a liberation movement, our young people and the civilian population trained militarily so that if there's anything, they could defend the country. So national service had started, before that, and it was a continuation as our experience as a liberation movement. So that's what national service is. And even now, if you look at the years when we had national service, 20 years now, over 90% of those who serve in national service have served in civilian jobs. They're not in the military. So if you look at our teachers, our health personnel working in agriculture, in other areas of the economy, these are national service people, and they're doing a civilian job, but they're national service. That's what you have. You also have national service in Europe. It doesn't mean national service is just linked with war. It's not. But in our situation, when you face an enemy, which is much bigger in size, and more importantly, that is supported by a superpower, you have to maintain a certain level of vigilance, as I said, of readiness. And especially during the war, 1998-2000, and then in the few years after the war, when the situation was still not stable, but not as stable as it is now, we had to maintain a larger number of young people in the military units. But since then, they've been serving mainly in the civilian service. So this is national service for Eritrea. National service has become now a topic of global conversation. It's something that never fails to surprise me. I go all over the world, and people who don't know what Eritrea is, where Eritrea is, first thing they ask you is national service. I say, how can national service in a very small country in this world become a topic of global conversation? But it has been turned into a topic of global conversation. And I think this shows you the power of institutions, including the media, to send a global agenda when Eritrea, the first thing that comes to mind when people mention Eritrea is national service. So this is the situation for us. National service for us, you know, in addition to what I said were the reasons for it, and there was another reason for it, and that was to help in national integration. As I said, this is a small country, but it's diverse. Not diverse just religious-wise, ethnically, but also in the different levels of socioeconomic development. So we felt to give our people from all over the country a common experience for a period of 18 months, you know, would help us build trust among the population, get the population to know each other, to have tolerance and harmony in the society, help us in national building and national integration. And we still believe it's a very important vehicle for us.
But within these 18 months, I'm a young man, 20 years, just finished school, I have to go to national service. A part of it is military, or nothing of it is military? It's
there is military training.
Trainings for some weeks, months? So I learn how
three to four months is military training.
Okay. Hmm?
As I said, in the beginning, yeah, people got military training 3 to 4 months, and then they served in the army for that time. Then when it became the time, you know, it was time, we changed that because we, you know, we needed people in our civilian service. So they are trained 3 to 4 months, and then they serve as teachers and whatever. So this is the way it is.
But, yeah, as you explain it, it sounds very logic and very understandable. But still, the people are complaining, and the main issue is, as you know, it's indefinite. So they are staying there for, they feel like, forever.
It's not indefinite at all.
But it takes sometimes more than 10 years.
Very few instances.
Why are these, why are these exceptions?
Because of the war, you know. As I told you, some people, there are people who have been in the army, some of them, okay, from 1998, you know, for 10 years or whatever, you know. We had to war. We had to defend this country. And when the war with Ethiopia started in 1998, 80% of our army was national service. We couldn't have defended.
Sure, that's quite some time ago. But yeah, still now,
yes,
people,
but that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. But then it didn't end there. Mm. And because it didn't end, we could not send everyone home. We still had to maintain a sizable part of them in the army. But not everyone who went to the national service there, almost no one from those who went to national service at that time are still in national service. Almost no one.
But if you take somebody in, a young person now, today, into the national service, you promise that this person is only serving for 18 months and then the person is off.
Again, as I said, you have to take into account what this nation went through. Situation in 1998 up to 2008 is different from the situation now. 1998 to 2008, you could probably say we still needed these people. And therefore,
sure, that's the past. But the present?
Again, now the present is completely different. You know, now people are taking military service, and then they're getting paid full salaries and entering the job market directly without even doing national service. This is the situation now as it exists, which is completely different from what it was. But the picture about the national service, the story that has been created, this narrative that has been created, very difficult to correct. It's not just national service. You hear so many stories about Eritrea.
Yeah. So, but coming to the presence, I understood you correctly. A student leaving school after 12th grade, this person might go to to the national service, or not, because you have no space for this person. So this person also might go straight to the college or start working and so on. That's a possibility too.
Yes, of course. What happens is, you know, you finish 11th grade. Wherever you live, 12th grade education is in a place called Sawa. So you finish your 12th grade education there. You take university entrance examinations, and then you take military training for about 3 months. After that,
Within Sava?
Yeah, within Sava. Mm-hmm. After that, depending on the grades that you get, those who have good grades go to the colleges or the universities. Those who have less grades go to community colleges, diploma courses, certificate courses. And those who have very low grades, we organize technical vocational education for them. So if you're a college student, you go to your college. 4 years, 5 years, 7 years, whatever it is, you do that. Once you finish, because if you're a college graduate, you do 1 year of community service because education is free in this country. So you do 1 year of community service. After that, now, you're getting your salaries and entering the job market. This is what's happening now. Okay? Can you choose what you want to do? To some extent, yes. Right now, the private sector does not have enough jobs for graduates in this country, but they have a job in the public sector. But if someone finds a job in the private sector, for example, there's a mining sector in this country which is private. So if someone finds a job in the mining sector, they can be released to go and take up their job in the mining sector. Once you graduate and you enter the job market, can you travel abroad? Can you go abroad? Right now, we're restricting that. Because of the situation we face, we don't want everyone to leave the country and go to Europe or wherever they want to. So we're making that, if they have a definite reason to go there, if they want to continue their education or there are other reasons, they can be allowed to go. But not everyone is allowed to go. This is the situation as it is right now.
Why are the people not allowed to go? Exactly because they... this would harm the economy, or what is the reason behind it?
Because they're going to become victims of human trafficking.
Give them just a passport and they could apply for a visa?
Sure, if they could, but who is going to give them a visa? No one is going to give them a visa. This is part of the problem of so-called migration policies in Europe. If you want to apply to go to Germany, here there's a German embassy. The chances that you're going to get a visa to go to Germany is 1 in 10,000, something like that. But if you arrive in Germany, if you're an Eritrean, the chance, not that you'll be allowed into Germany, but the chance that you'll be given political asylum to live there and work there is almost 100%. So they're not going to get their visas here. That's what they will do is they will go to Sudan, and from there they will go to Libya, and from Libya they will try to cross the Mediterranean to go to Germany.
I have one more question to the National Service, and then we go a little bit to the refugees. The National Service, I met some people here, and they are in the National Service. They told me they hate it, and they want to leave, and they've been there for a lot more than 18 months. So are they lying?
There are people who have been in National Service for a longer period of time. Did you ask them what they're doing? Did you ask them what they were doing?
They were working.
Yeah, so they're working.
They're working for the state, but they were like, they were not free in choosing their job, they said.
It's possible. It's possible, but are there jobs for them? These are the questions that that we need to ask. Yes, there could be people who want to go, for instance, wherever they want to go. It's possible for them, but they're working. They're working here. Many are doing even their own private work, private enterprises. It doesn't surprise me that you can find some young person here who can tell you that. But there, you can ask others as well. There are many young people who are here who are not in national service, or even if they're not in their national service, are doing jobs that they like. You're a medical student. You graduate from the medical school here. 7 years, you become a doctor. You're a doctor working in a government hospital. You can say, I don't like this, I want to open my clinic, or I want to go to Germany. You can say that, and you may not like that. But this is a developing country, and it's providing for its young people. Education in this country is free from elementary to even postgraduate school. This is a poor country, it's a developing country, and provides possibilities to young people. It should expect them to serve for some time. I don't see any harm in it.
But still, I see a contradiction in, on the one side, you said you don't want the people to leave, but on the other hand side, what do you have to offer? You said that the economy is very weak and you have to do to attract them somehow.
Sure, but that takes time.
But they are young, they want to have children, family.
They can have
How long have they got to wait? What do you tell them? I have my job in Germany, so what do you tell your young people?
They have jobs here as well, you know.
Where?
Here in this country, they have jobs. You should not imagine that these people in Europe are people who didn't have a job. They're not. They're people who are working. Some people were well-to-do. Some people were better off living here in Eritrea than they are in Germany now.
But why did they leave?
Isn't it natural for some young people to think that they would rather live in Germany rather than in Eritrea? There are many Eritreans in Germany, you know, since the 1980s. You'll find that almost every family in this country has a son, a daughter, a father, a mother living abroad. This is a globalized world. You ask these questions. You know, you should ask the same questions about Italy or Greece or Portugal or Ireland. You know, at one time when Ireland was going through a difficult economic situation, you know, every year 160,000 young people, graduates, were leaving Ireland to go to America or to other places where they felt there were better opportunities. This is normal.
Okay, but they didn't have to take any harsh routes to go there and
sure.
So on. Yeah. So and.
Sure.
And yeah, okay. So then you could go back to why do you give them just visa or like not visa but passports and so on.
But I'm telling you that does not. We have asked a number of European countries, including Germany, if we can have a legal, you know, an agreement for legal migration. We've said it very simply. Okay, Germany, they want 100 Eritreans every year. Can we make a deal that you would give them visas so that they could go to Germany legally? You know, take the plane from Asmara and go to Germany to work, to study. We put the same question to all the European countries. Every single European country says no. There is no legal way to go to Europe. The only way to go to Europe now is illegal.
Yeah.
And we are part of this discussions on migration. You know, we had this very huge conference, you know, in Valletta.
Mm.
The whole African side was raising the issue of legal mobility. And Europe says, yes, lip service, but nothing happens. There is no legal mobility to go to Europe. I'll give you a number of examples. For example, we have cyclists here, world-class cyclists who compete at the highest levels. Now it's a bit easier for them because they're known internationally, but for many years it was difficult for them to get a visa here in Asmara to go to compete in an international competition in Europe. They would not be allowed visas. So this is the situation, this is the reality, even for someone who's going to compete on a world scale.
It's not only said that the people leave because of economical situation, it's because of human rights. Big issue. There's this United Nations report, you know it better than I. So Eritrea is always linked to human rights violation. And there are a lot of things that they are listed, like there's no election, no real constitution ever applied, no people are imprisoned without being tried, and so on and so on. How would you describe how in terms of human rights, where is Eritrea in your point of view?
This is one of the best countries in this continent for the protection of human rights and human dignity. I'll just put it very simply like that.
But you have no constitution, for example. You have no press freedom. The people can't speak on the street loudly about politics and so on.
It's not true. They speak loudly. They speak loudly to me. My job is to speak to people, to hold meetings. I hold meetings here in the country, abroad, everywhere, young people, old people, women. They speak their mind very openly and very articulately. There's no problem there. They speak their minds. They have no problem.
They're not afraid of police, not afraid of some secret service.
Are there police, DDC police in this country? You know, this is the story in this Commission of Inquiry report, that this country is full of guns. People are not only afraid to speak, but they are afraid to think. This is what this Commission of Inquiry report says. This is nonsense. This is a country where people are free, feel free. They walk any time of the day, any time of the night. They speak to each other freely. They speak to any official freely. Mm. Nothing happens to them.
But they can't move freely. There are limitations. Like you can go as you, you are very exceptional, but a normal person from Asmara can easily go to Massawa, for example. But
what? Yeah, anywhere in the country.
But there are limitations. That if you go further on, you have to have a certain permission. It's not just sitting into the car and going there.
No, you can travel anywhere in the country freely. Anywhere
as an Eritrean.
As an Eritrean, yes. As an Eritrean, you're free to live, to travel anywhere in the country freely.
Even to the border?
Yeah, of course. But then, you know, if in the border you're going to be asked, you know. Listen, you know, I mean, this is a joke. You know. If people are living illegally, this nation has a responsibility to try to protect its borders. So you have to, you know, put certain... certain mechanisms in place so that he can at least bring down that level. But this is not from any desire to restrict the movement of people inside the country. It's not true. So people are free to travel inside the country. Like I said, they're free to move. And again, this is one of the best countries for human dignity and human rights in this continent.
Why don't you have a free press?
What is a free press?
Like opposition, not like private newspapers. Everything belongs to the state. So, no criticism on towards government and so on. I do not understand your language, but it's at least the things I've heard.
So it's not true. It's not true. There are critical pieces, articles.
What do they criticize, for example?
Whatever they want to criticize.
Give me three examples. What is criticized by the media in the last by Eritrean media in the last months?
Anything, you know, the services that they get, if they feel there are abuses, they criticize that. Whatever the issue of the day is, if the prices are going high, the economic situation or the health...
They complain about these 5,000 Nakba to withdraw within a month, for example?
Sure. They talk about it, yeah.
Petrol prices?
There is no petrol price. What petrol price?
No, right, about the petrol prices.
They talk about it, yeah, but what... Mm. I'm telling you, you know, there are many, many forums that we have in this country, and it's not just a newspaper which comes out, every day, and it's 4 or 5 pages, you know. Mm. There are better ways of communication within the society, and that communication is a direct, interactive communication between the government and the people, where all sorts of issues are raised. For example, I'll just give you an example of the structures of the movement itself, where members of the movement, which is a fairly large number, you're not talking about an elite, a very small group of people, but hundreds of thousands of people meet regularly every month, and all these issues are discussed. For example, the issue of the currency has been discussed twice over the past 2 months, and all these issues are brought there. And the movement tries to explain why these changes were made, what we're trying to achieve, what the negative sides are, what the positive sides are, and how we believe we're going to overcome this. So these are issues that are discussed. I don't want to go into a theoretical discussion about the press, you know, that's something, you know. I have seen the press, I have seen how it reports Eritrea, and I say, okay, that's something else.
Mm-hmm. So, how would you describe the political system of Eritrea? What kind of state do you have? Have you a name for that?
For us, you know, the main characteristic for our political system is that it is a political system based on citizenship, which is completely different from what you see in much of Africa. In much of Africa, the state is beholden to a certain group, whether it is a small group, a family group, or an ethnic group, or a religious group, or a tribal group. This is the, one of the fundamental problems of the state in much of Africa. It does not call itself, you know, a government for this ethnic group or for this tribe or for this religious group, but in essence, that's what it is. I don't want to talk about other countries, but I can just give you a small example about a neighboring country, Ethiopia, okay, for instance. This is supposed to be this democratic federal government, okay, but it is a state that is beholden to a small minority, which is the Tigrayan group, which is about 5% of the population, and the majority ethnic groups in the country are marginalized and alienated from it, with variations here and there. This is the picture of the state in much of Africa. This is completely different from our situation here in Eritrea. It's a state based on citizenship.
But how do I, can I be a member of this citizenship? How does it work? How can I, as a normal, ordinary Eritrean, how can I somehow influence the government that has been established on what? It's not been elected, it's been self-elected. Describe it to me, please. How does Eritrea politically work?
Very simple. This is a movement that fought for independence. Every single Eritrean family fought in this movement. Every single Eritrean family lost a daughter or a son fighting for this movement. This is the movement that set up this government. And it has an administrative structure throughout the country where people have a say, not just in elections that come every 4 or 5 years, but on a daily basis. For me, if you ask me about elections, I think they are overrated, especially in Africa. There are hardly true elections in this continent. We had one-party states for a long time in Africa, and the people in power learned to play a different game, and they become masters at it. So they hold elections. The constitution says they can only be elected to 2 terms. They change the constitution. They get elected for a 3rd term. If they feel that they're not going to win, they rig the elections. Anyway, so that's the rest. For us, this is a very simple government where there is daily interaction between citizen and government at different levels. We have local elections, for example, at a local level. So you elect your administrators at that local level. We have regional elections. We have 6 regions in the country. We have regional elections. We have not held national elections yet. We will hold them at one point in time. But for me, again, you know, it's how people like to talk about these issues that is the problem. There are many people who tell us, you know, we know constitutions, you know, in Africa, but also in many other parts of the world. They're not worth the paper that they're written on. What's written on the constitution and what happens in daily life are completely different. There's absolutely no relations between the two. They tell us elections are nothing. But then they said, why don't you play the game?
But how can you be sure that you're right, that you take the right decisions? Who's challenging you? Who is controlling you?
Again, you know, this is, you know, you talk about who is challenging you, who is controlling you, you know. I sometimes say, do we really live in the real world, you know? You talk about, again, talk about elections. Who is controlling governments all over this world? Can you really tell me? Do you really believe, you know, that citizens in these nations all over the world really control their government? Do you really believe that?
At least every 4 or 5 years.
I don't think even those 4 or 5 years, even those 4 or 5 years, there are forces much bigger than the citizen that control, you know, how politics is run in these countries. So this idea, I think it's a very simplistic one, and this is why people are telling us to play the game. We would like to develop our own, you know, slowly, gradually build a state that is responsive to the population and that is very close to the population, in which the population has an influence on a daily basis. This is what we're trying to do. And I think, you know, we have certain elements of that. There isn't any person in this government, any official in this government, walks the streets of this country freely without any bodyguards. Yeah.
What measures do you have to control, to be controlled, and so on? And where do you get your inspiration from? You said, okay, you go to the people, you talk to the people. But still, you are in power since 25 years or 23 years, and you could say we've been lucky that it went so well in a way, but it could have been wrong.
No.
So what is?
No, it's in places where there are elections and there is no true representation that you get problems. There are systems that are, you know, nominally so-called democratic, have elections and all these things. But it's a sham. And once people know, they don't stand for it.
I'm with you. I'm quite familiar with Africa. I've been living some years in Africa in different countries. And they are like Namibia, Mozambique and so on. And they all have been running by one party all the time, though being elected. So democracy is obviously not really working. In some countries, it probably works a little bit better. We have changing of governments and so on. But still, okay, that leads us into a very long discussion, but I understood your point. I would like to come back to the young people. Three points, name them, please. What do you offer for the future? Young people, please stay here in Eritrea, because...
This is your country. That's the first thing. This is your country. This is where you belong. This is where you're a master. Everywhere else, you don't belong there. Yeah, you could take up citizenship, but this is the natural place for you. This is the most important one. Secondly, this is a nation that has a future. There's a future as a prosperous, as a just society. Thirdly, I believe in the long term, people have more opportunities here than especially in the developed world. You know, if you're an engineer here, you can do more. If you're an engineer in Germany, where there are tens of thousands of engineers, your role is going to be very limited, and probably you can end up without a job as an engineer, and he can end up becoming a taxi driver or whatever it is.
But how do you, what are you going to develop? What are your projects? Because you need money for that. Do you have money for developed things?
I don't believe the key is money. It's not money. We have, for us, the most important ingredient for development is peace. It's stability. It's a cohesive society. This is what we have experience is. You can build and take decades, half a century to build, and you can destroy it in two, 3 years.
But you have peace. So now you can start.
That's a very important ingredient. Okay. That's what I'm saying. It is the most important ingredient for development, is peace. Secondly, we have a government that functions. If you look at some of our achievements, for instance, achievements in health, what is it due to? It's not due to money. It's due to organization. Organization in the society, organization in the government. This is a government that can deliver. So you have that government which is clean, which is not corrupt, which is committed to development, which has the organizational capacity to deliver. I think that's a very important requirement. Three, we have abundant resources for a small country. You could talk about the strategic location of the country, which is an important asset for Eritrea. It's a very important one. We have human resources. We have a really skilled population, a talented youth with many possibilities. And we have sufficient natural resources for a small country like Eritrea, whether it's water, land, other natural resources, minerals. We have those resources as well. So it's for us, we have all the ingredients for success. The past 15 years of 18 years really of conflict, of external hostility, have been difficult for us. But we're emerging from that, and I think people are beginning to see that things are moving in the positive direction in this country.
Can you name me some projects that are on the way, or?
The most important thing for us is agriculture. This is what we've been investing in. We've been conserving soil, water, building an agricultural infrastructure, because still agriculture is the sector where most of our people are living on right now.
But do you think in modernizing agriculture, in industrializing agriculture? Or do you just want to support the peasants, the small farmers?
Well, that's not just a subsistence farming, of course, but support the farmers to grow more, to grow better, to be more productive. So agriculture is a basis for food production, horticulture production, but also for agro-processing. It's the basis for us. We have a big market across the sea here for our produce. This is the beginning. We're developing our educational systems and skill systems. That's another very important asset. We believe at the end of the day we're going to compete, on the skills level and educational levels of our population. So that's a very important factor in terms of development that we're working on. We're trying to develop our ports. That's another important thing. Yes, transportation and transportation services are going to be very important for Eritrea.
For example, the street or the road to Karen was in bad shape. A lot of trucks from the Nefson mine are coming, destroying, obviously, because they are very heavy, destroying the tarmac. But there was no road maintenance, so I was wondering where is at least taking place this small development, maintenance and so on. Even that I haven't seen.
No, the maintenance takes place regularly. That's why it's still in this condition with all the damage that it gets on a daily basis. So we maintain that, but we're also, these are roads
from Italy, so
78 years ago. They were built for that time. Now we're thinking of modernizing the infrastructure in the country. If you think about roads going to the west of the country, to Sudan, to link with Sudan, that's not the ideal route. There are easier, more efficient, shorter routes even to go to where they're going now. Those are the things that we're trying to build. So the roads, the railway, our ports, our airports,
the telecommunication. Improve,
modernize all of
modernize,
them.
Modernize and so on. Where do you get the money from? You have your own money, or where are you looking on the international market? How do you? Because it's said that you want to avoid getting help from outside.
No, we don't want to become dependent, and we don't want to become dependent forever. Those are different things from not accepting help. We have no problem from cooperation. If people want to cooperate with us, they're most welcome. That's not a problem. The problem has been in the past 18 years, for instance, that every effort has been made so that Eritrea does not get any partnership, any cooperation at all. The United States tried to prevent us even from taking out loans to build, for example, our mining sector. So a lot of effort has been made. The United States has tried to prevent Eritreans from sending remittances to their country. A lot of efforts have been made. But for us, if it's genuine partnership and cooperation, it's most welcome.
But I haven't seen any, for example, NGO, hardly any foreign money comes in, at least from Europe, what I've noticed.
Again, you know, people have not wanted to cooperate with us, but now, recently, there is cooperation developing between Europe and Eritrea. There is an EU cooperation agreement for about 200 million euros over 5 years for energy. We're talking with Germany for a cooperation agreement on renewable energy and vocational training. We have a very small cooperation agreement with Finland to improve the education in this country. We have cooperation agreements with the Gulf countries. China provides some cooperation. The African Development Bank is here with loans.
The so you UN, would say that this is improving, this has been improving the last year. You went through isolation and now you go more into the outside world, we could say that?
It's not us. We have always wanted to interact with the international world. Just look at Eritrea, just look at its location. Okay. On the Red Sea, a maritime country, 1,200 kilometers coastline, a bridge between the Middle East and Africa. You look at that location. The only way this country can thrive is if it capitalizes on its strategic location. So so-called isolation, trying to isolate itself, is not a viable strategy for Eritrea. It's not what we want to do. We want to interact with the world. And if you go back to history, it was a crossroad for many, many civilizations. So this is our strategy. It's not us that is trying to reach out to the world. I think to some extent it's the world now beginning to re-engage with Eritrea. There was a time, if you look at our history, until 1991, no one wanted to deal with us. We were fighting a just war, a liberation war. No one wanted to support us. Everyone was opposed to Eritrean independence. 1991, we became independent. Many countries wanted to work with us, and that happened until 1998. 98, the war restarted, and everyone abandoned Eritrea. Now that we have overcome this difficult phase, people are beginning to engage with Eritrea. People are beginning to remember that there's a country called Eritrea in a very strategic region of the world, a region that is key for peace, for security, for international maritime transport. And people are beginning to get interested and to engage with Eritrea again.
When you hear the news, that's a small question only, when you hear the news that about 20 Eritreans have died in the Sea Mediterranean, what do you personally feel?
Pain. Pain, sadness. There is something that that people don't understand abroad. When someone dies, an Eritrean dies anywhere in the world, it is someone who is not very far from you. It's a neighbor, he's a family member, he's a son, a daughter, something very close. This is a very small country. This is a very small society. And it's not something, you know, just there, you know, some, you know, country of 50 million people or a billion people where you know, you don't feel that personal thing. This is completely different. So it is that feeling that that affects not just Eritreans here, but all over the world. And this is why we're working so hard to change the situation. This is why we have been engaging with Europe to try to persuade Europe to abandon this policy, which is also contributing to the death, not just of Eritreans, but of many others. We feel that the migration policies of European countries need to be revised. They're completely wrong. They are not working.
I've been reading that you've been one of the few people, official person that is allowed to visit this Ereiro prison. Is it correct? Did I pronounce it rightly? It's on the way to Massawa from here. Can you describe me a little bit the situation in this prison?
I've never been there. I've never been there.
Okay. You know what it stands for?
No. These are part of these stories.
Okay, then we can clarify that. It's no problem. Okay, so this prison doesn't exist, or?
I'm not saying it doesn't exist, you know. I'm just saying it's a place where some detainees are held.
But why is it so special then?
There's nothing special about it. It's just like all these stories that you hear about Eritrea.
Okay, and it's not true that these so-called 15 G15 members or some of them are stationed there or imprisoned there?
Yes. So what's the issue there?
Because it's like one of the points that also leads Eritrea to this bad corner.
No, it's not true. It's not true. Eritrea's relations with Europe have nothing to do with human rights. You know, the attitude towards Eritrea has nothing to do with human rights. If it was due to human rights, Europe and the United States would be talking about other countries and not about Eritrea. This is the reality. This is the truth. I don't want to talk about countries, but there are countries where citizens have no value, and the life of a person has absolutely no value, where leaders loot, you know, where they are common thieves and common murderers. Just listen to me. And no one says anything about it. Mm. But for Eritrea, this is the situation. So I'm saying I challenge everyone, and this is what Eritrea said in the Human Rights Council meeting these past weeks. Eritrea is being treated unfairly for reasons that have nothing to do with human rights. It has nothing to do with human rights. The people who are criticizing Eritrea, many of them, have worse human rights records than Eritrea.
I agree, but still people discuss it. What happened to these G15, the journalists that have been sacked in 2001? What is their situation? Are they still alive?
Again, do you know who these people are? Do you know what they did?
They criticized the president, of what I've heard.
No.
What did they do?
It's not true. Again, this is what I'm saying.
Tell me the truth.
I know these people, you know, these were leaders of this country.
I know, yeah.
These were military commanders of this country.
Yeah.
These people were in the command post of the Eritrean army during the war. They're responsible for what happened during the war.
Yes, and then?
That's not a criticism of the government, and they are not in prison for criticizing the government or the president.
Well, why are they in prison then?
I just told you.
Because they've been at war, or
I
didn't understand. Then you have to clarify.
It is very clear. These are people who, at the height of the war, conspired with the enemy, and their dealings with the enemy led to the death of thousands of Eritreans.
And what about the journalists?
They were part of that group working together at that time.
And have they ever been trialed? You mean going to court and so on?
In our own way, yes.
What is the own way?
The own way is to have an internal process to study this.
But did they have a lawyer, for example?
No.
So they had to defend themselves, or were they allowed to defend?
Listen, you know, what kind of issues are you talking about? Are you talking about an ordinary civilian issue? This is completely different. I'm telling you, this is war. You know, these are military commanders. We could have court-martialed them, which is a different approach. There are ways that armies deal with these issues.
So this was under like war circumstances, and that is probably another situation like you have now, for example.
I'm sorry.
They were charged in a time when Eritrea was still in a war situation. And that, therefore, there was a special treatment.
I'm just saying they are in detention because of their actions during a war, which compromised the survival and the independence of this country, and led to the death of many Eritreans. This is the issue, and I believe that Eritrea should be commended for how it dealt with this issue, because there could have been other ways of dealing with it.
What other ways?
I don't want to go into that, but we didn't do it. We know how others deal with these issues.
But from my understanding, these people are sitting in prison without being trialed.
Your understanding is wrong of the situation. You have absolutely no idea of what you're speaking about.
Therefore, I'm here and getting some clarification.
So that's what I told you. I told you that these are people who are at the military command post, military commanders during a war where Eritrea lost 20,000 young people, and they compromised the independence, the sovereignty, and the survival of this nation.
How do they feel? How do they do? Are they still living?
Again, I wouldn't know. This is not an issue I'd like to discuss. But I'm saying again, this is part of the story and narrative that has been created about Eritrea. Go into all these countries where so much has happened. Mm. And there's silence about it. Yesterday, in this past 4 months, the Ethiopian government killed something like 700 or almost peacefully protesting. And it has imprisoned tens of thousands.
But is this justifying your...
No, I'm just talking about double standards. I'm talking about these double standards. This is the problem that Eritrea is facing. For us, this is a very important issue.
It's a top secret issue, obviously. Why
should I talk about it? It's not a sensitive issue in that sense. It's an issue that affects us because these are people who are part of our movement, who made their contribution. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine a country where someone who's a minister is now in detention and his family still continues to live in that government-issued villa? So I say, we handled this thing very well, and it's very important for us that we handled it this way.
What way?
The way we have.
Like secretly, not public, not talking about
it. It's not that. We talk about it internally. When this happened...
But do you think about the families and so on? Their families, what do they know?
They know.
Have they been told of what is going on?
They know they are part of us. They are part of our movement. I'm telling you, this issue was discussed. What they told was explained to the population. This is the way we have handled it.
So you talked openly about what happened that in 2000?
Of course.
Yeah, okay. What do you expect from Germany in the next years?
I think not from Germany, but from Europe and from the world, is to give fair treatment to Eritrea. It's as simple as that. It's not expectation. Eritrea is a country of opportunities, and people should look at Eritrea as a country of opportunities. It's not a problem. It's not a problem to solve. There are many other problems to solve in this part of the world. Eritrea is not one of them.
That's also very important. We have refugees, as you know, in Germany, many, many thousands of Eritrea. What do you tell them if they would like to come back, even if they have left the national service?
They come back all the time.
They're coming. And they're not going to be imprisoned because it said that if you leave national service, you have to go to prison for 8 months and so on?
They're coming back, and they're going back to Germany if they want to. If they want to stay, they're welcome to stay.
So they can even swap?
Of course, they can come back and go. And they do that every summer. Every summer, if you come here in the summer, even now there may be some, but every summer thousands of them come. They spend the summer here, visit their families, and go back to Germany.
And they are not going to be trapped in the airport right away from the border.
Thousands of them come every summer and go back. So not just from Germany, but from all over the world, yeah.
Yeah, I've seen them, yeah. So they do not have to fear anything. They left the country whilst they've been to national service. They escaped, they fled, they went through all this hell, Sudan, Libya, and so on, Sea Mediterranean, enter in Europe, and after, let's say, 2 years, they recognize, no, this is no way for me. I want to go back to my country, to my home, and I'm not facing any problems there when I come back.
They do that all the time. As soon as they get their papers from the German government, the next day they come to the embassy in Berlin or to the consulate in Frankfurt, get their papers. They want to come, they come, they come regularly. They do it every year in tens of thousands.
And they're not punished in some way, in any way?
I'm telling you, they come here and they go back.
Yeah, but
very
you're not,
simple.
But you're not answering directly my question. Are they punished or not?
Because it's the wrong question to ask. They wouldn't come. If that was the case, if they were going to be punished, they would not come. They come every single time. The Eritrean government is on record. The president himself went on national television and said, no one in this country has the authority to prevent an Eritrean citizen from coming back to the country. This is their right. And no one is going to touch them when they come back. But he said, I have an advice for those people who have left the country illegally. Since you're there, go to school, learn a skill, make some money. So when you come back, you will not be a burden on the society, but you can contribute.
Last question about these 2%. Is it compulsory for somebody living outside to pay these 2% or not? Or is it like a free donation?
It is compulsory if you have an income. If you're going to school, if you don't have an income, you don't pay it. If you make an income, we give the government 2% of your net income after you pay your taxes. Again, this is your contribution to the society. This is a rehabilitation tax, that's what we call it. It was introduced in 1992. No one spoke about it for 20 years, and then suddenly it is the issue because Eritrea is being targeted. It has nothing to do with 2%. It has everything to do with politically targeting Eritrea. I understand that when the unification of Germany took place, Germany introduced a solidarity tax of 9%. This is Eritrea after 30 years of war, after 30 years of destruction, after the loss of 100,000 people, after tens of thousands of disabled, after tens of thousands of orphans. It introduced a rehabilitation tax so that every citizen can contribute to the rebuilding of the society. This is something that should be applauded, commended, because Eritrea is trying to find its own solution to its own problems. But instead of that, we're attacked because of political reasons.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.